The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Tommy Smith is the most famous loud man in America. And he's coming in to chat to us today. That's Smith with a Y. He's a sports commentator and pundit, and we spoke to him before. He's a big fan of Dundalk, and he's a great story to tell, and he's a very colourful character, so I'm really looking forward to talking to him later on. Theresa Mannion is going to be talking to us as well, and we'll be talking to Ray and Alison about relationships, and I'll tell you more about that anon. Of course, all the talk today is about RT Investigates, Crashes Behind Closed Doors. And I watched it last night. What a great piece of investigative journalism. And Paul McGuire and his team are doing great work over there. It's as a parent who's had children in creches, it was a very difficult watch. And I'm sure there are parents all over the country. And although they know that their creche is doing a fine job and everybody who works there is caring for their children to the utmost of their ability, it does cast doubts, doesn't it? You do start to think. And it's a huge leap of trust, if that's a phrase, to hand over your child to somebody you half know or don't know and to leave your child with them for 8 to 10 hours in a day. And of course, most children up to the age of 2, 3, can't communicate what's going on. So you have to take the word of the person who's handing you back your child that they played with Lego, they ate a lovely fish pie, or whatever. And in most cases, in the 4,500 creches around the country, what the staff tell you is the truth. But what we saw last night was very, very disturbing. Very disturbing. And you just have to feel sorry for the parents who have children in the hide-and-seek creches. You'd have to feel sorry for the staff there. And you even saw last night that a lot of the staff are questioning some of the practices. So they wanted what was best for the children. How the children were roughly treated. I've been listening to everybody this morning, today and listen to, and I'm not sort of encouraged by what I've been hearing. Like, oftentimes when it comes to regulations, be it of road safety or creches or whatever, unless the regulations and the laws are enforced and policed, they're not worth the paper they're written on. And it's a tricky one, isn't it, to police regulations around creches, because as I said, the children don't have a voice. They can't come home and say, "Mammy, a woman flipped me over onto my belly and then put her hand on my head and forced me down onto the mattress until I slept." They can't communicate that. So what do you do about policing this? Okay, you can have unannounced checks by Tootsie or whatever, but once they get to the front door, the behaviour of everybody changes and everybody's on high alert. And I know that having CCTV cameras isn't the answer, but at least then people would behave accordingly because they know that Big Brother, Tootsie, whoever was watching them. And do we need that sort of thing? Is that the answer? Like Breach of Trust, which was a similar type primetime special, was broadcast 6 years ago, May 2013. And a lot of things were said in the wake of that, and a lot of things were changed, and Tootsie was introduced and all that. But here we are 6 years on, talking the same talk and asking the same questions. And that's not good, is it? That's not good. Anyway, if you missed it, it's one of those things you have to watch, and it will be uncomfortable to watch. It's not pleasant viewing in any way, shape or form, but it's one of the things you have to know about, particularly if you have children. I was looking at something there. There's an article on the RTE website, and it's giving you advice on what to do if you have a child in a creche and the questions to ask. And I'll get to that later on. It's just tips of what to do. So visit the creche. There's just how to tell if a creche is suitable for your child. So visit the creche, they're saying. Examine the environment and facilities. As a parent, what you should do. Ask them about their policies. What are the policies that the creche has in terms of health and safety? What happens if the child has an accident? What do they do? What do they do if the child cries? And you should feel welcomed yourself. So the door should always be open. And when you're visiting, maybe visit at a time that might surprise them a bit. So that's good advice there. Good advice. It's up on the RTE website there, how to tell if a creche is suitable for your child. And as I say, 4,500 creches around the country, and the majority of those are doing a very good job. And it's you're conflicted as a parent handing your child over, because you know, if you didn't have to pay the mortgage, and if we lived in an ideal world, that you'd probably stay at home with your child. But we don't live in an ideal world, so you have to go out and work to pay the mortgage, and you have to get somebody to mind your child, and you're handing over your child to somebody you don't know, and it's one of those big decisions, and there's loads of emotions going around in your head, and there's conflict and all sorts of things, and then you see that last night, and whoa. Anyway, so that's that. We were talking, I'll come to the rings in a moment, but we got a lovely email in to ray@rte.ie, just a short one. He says, it's from Dave in Artane. I know you like your random acts of kindness, so I wanted to tell you of one I saw on the way to work this morning. As I was walking down to my local Dara station, I saw up ahead an elderly woman with a walker struggling to get her bin out to the curb for collection. Before I could get to her to help, a young guy who was about 20 came around the corner and instantly came to her aid. He wheeled the bin the 20 yards out to the curb for her, then went back to check if she was okay and if she needed any other assistance. It was heartwarming. It was a random act of kindness on a normal Thursday morning, says Dave. Isn't that lovely? Because young people, they say, get a lot of flack. I don't know if they do anymore, but that's what they used to say. Young people get a lot of flack. We were talking rings yesterday, and our Jen got engaged over the weekend, and it's an engagement ring. That's what happened, you see. All the girls in the office wanted to see the ring. Not one male until today asked to see the ring. That's the difference between men and women. Anyway, when I got to see it today, it's a big one. It's a big one. And I could see that Jen would be very upset if she lost it. So it doesn't fit quite well. So she's gone out and got... I've never heard of one of these before. It's a ring snuggie. So it's a sort of a jelly, rubbery type thing that you put on underneath the ring to make it snugly fit your finger until such time as you get it resized. But Jen is so in love with her ring and so worried that she might lose it after all the stories we got yesterday that she had a stress dream last night about losing her ring. Yeah, well, there you go. Hopefully she doesn't lose it, and at least if she loses in a hotel, she might get it back. I see that the Premier Inns have revealed the weirdest things guests have left in their hotel rooms over the last year. So these are the oddest top three things left in Premier Inn hotel rooms over the last year. A goldfish, a glass slipper, and a gas mask. Now, what were people doing with a goldfish, a glass slipper, and a gas mask? Oh, it wasn't in the one room. They were in separate rooms. Yeah. Yeah. And they also found a large-scale professional family portrait. The most popular things, as you would expect, phone chargers, toothbrushes and toiletries. They're the most popular ones. Then soft toys are another popular one, and books. And if you're worried about the poor little goldfish, he has since been adopted by a team member and nicknamed Bab. They don't explain why. The gas mask, still there, waiting for collection. They just want to see the person who's coming to collect the gas mask that's left in a hotel room. Because that's the thing about hotel rooms, isn't it? They're sort of, you know, people do things they wouldn't do probably at home in hotel rooms, don't they? You know they do. You know they do. And of course, they sleep in hotel rooms. I see today that women are better, sorry, men are better sleepers than women. So it's the gender nap gap, if you know what I mean. So women lose 3 hours of sleep a night compared to men, and the men are to blame. A beds company survey showed that women miss out on 3 hours of sleep every night. That's how many is that? That's 1,005 hours a year. 45 days of missed sleep. Their partner snoring is an issue for many women. Period pains and waking up to look after kids also interrupt women's sleep. That's what they say. But is it true from your experience? The snoring thing, they still, you would think if they can send a man to the moon and if they can get all sorts of things going, if we can have a computer in our pockets that allows us to access all the information in the world, you would think that they'd have come up with a cure for snoring, but they haven't. Not yet. Well wishes coming in for Tommy already. So he has fans in Ireland as well as America. Tommy Smith, that's Smith with a Y. And we'll be talking to him very shortly. 51551, ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. That's a good cheery summer tune. 51551 for your text and send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Of course, the other thing we were chatting about when it comes to engagement rings is, as a man, what do you do? Do you go out and buy it and have it there for the proposal? Do you trust your judgment that your wife-to-be will like the ring? It's a big risk to take, isn't it? It's a big risk to take. Or do you get something from Claire's Accessories and that's the substitute one and you go, will you marry me? This is a ring, it's not the ring, and we can go and pick out a ring together. Or do you do like Eric did? He had the confidence to go and pick out a ring. And our Jen loves it. I'm sure that isn't always the case. I'm sure there are men out there who thought they could do it, that they knew exactly what their fiancé wanted in a ring. And what do you do if you're proposed to by the man you love and want to spend the rest of your life with and he presents you with a piece of jewellery that you don't like? There's conflict. They go, I do, but I don't. I do want to marry and I do want to spend the rest of my life with you, but I don't like the ring. Sorry, don't like the ring. Yeah, it's a big one. We did the agree, go and pick it out, and then it was left to me to propose whenever, you know, so that was the surprise element. Now, people would say that that takes the romance out of it, but we had the children and the house already, so... Our on relationship still, Alison Keating, psychologist, and Ray O'Neill, psychoanalyst, our relationship counsellors, experts, will be here after 4 o'clock. So if you want their advice on your relationship woes, get them into us now, ray@rte.ie, and they always give very sound advice. They don't always agree with each other, but you'll get advice from two different perspectives. So ray@rte.ie, if you want advice from Alison Keating, psychologist, Ray O'Neill, psychoanalyst, they will be with us after 4 o'clock. Loads of texts coming in about Tommy Smith, that's Smith with the Y, and we're going to be talking to him after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551 for your texts. Now, I'm joined in Studio 10 by the most famous loud man in America, Tommy Smith. That's Smith with a Y. Tommy, great to have you in studio.
Great to meet you. It's great to sit across from you, believe me.
Now, we spoke to you before, but you'll have to explain yourself to people, because unless people...
I usually do.
Yes. When did you leave Loud?
I left Loud, I'll be gone actually, my anniversary is coming up next week, the 3rd of August 1963, so I'll be there 56 years next Friday.
Right.
I'll be at the Galway races, but I'm there 56 years.
What was your intention when you were leaving Loud to go to America?
You know, that's a question an awful lot of people ask, and I really didn't have any intention. I had an old aunt, my Aunt Minnie, who would come home every year, and she'd be always saying to me, oh, come to America, right? And sure, I started telling the boys around Knockbridge, the boys in the Bride's football, that I was going to go to America, and then it stuck. Oh, and yeah. Then I had no way out.
I had to go. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it certainly was.
Yeah, Knockbridge, County Louth is where you're originally from.
Yeah, a small little parish down. It's about 4 miles outside of Dundalk.
And had you got a trade or anything?
No, I wasn't 17. I had worked in the foundry in Dundalk as a by labourer was the term in those days. I'm not sure it exists now, but I left there and I headed to New York, and the rest is a wee bit of, I don't know, history or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, but you're 16, 17. What do you do when you land in New York?
Well, I had my aunt with me and, you know, unfortunately, I was only there 2 days when her husband died. So that left me in a real bad situation because I had no job and she was in any shape to take me around to get a job. So I had to forage my way around New York a little bit on my own looking for a job. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. No, you know, you learn quickly.
It was the makings of you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, if you don't learn, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And was it a bit of the boy becoming a man overnight?
Well, I'm not sure the boy has ever become a man, but right, overnight for that, definitely. Yeah.
And it's funny you say that, because that's your appeal, isn't it? Your sort of your boy-like enthusiasm for what you do.
Yeah, well, I love what I do. You know, I consider myself very lucky, and I always say to people, and Americans always say to me, you know, I always say, if there is an American dream, I have achieved that American dream, because, I mean, I live the life that most people, most football fans and things would give their life.
So how did you get from walking around the streets of New York as a 17-year-old looking for a job, foraging for a job, as you say, lovely description, to being a regular on ESPN? And now NFL on Amazon. How did that happen?
Well, it was a long journey with a big ladder. And I slid down it many times. I had about 17 different jobs over the years. And in fact, my first job, I went into a hotel looking for a job. And when the woman saw my passport, she said, no, I'm sorry, I can't give you a job. She said, you're too young. You can't work until you're over 18. And she said, but if you come back tomorrow with some proof that you're 18, she said. She was French, and she obviously figured another European, right? So I went away and I did a masterful job, and I made myself 18 overnight. And that was the first job I got. I got a job in the Biltmore Hotel in New York as an electrician's helper. And then I went on, I worked, because I had promised mom and dad that I wouldn't stay away any longer than 2 years. And in the States, you only get like 2 weeks holidays. There's no such a thing as getting 3 or 4 weeks holidays. So every year I'd have to quit the job I had, because I had to come home, had to see mom and dad, I had to go to the Galway races. So it was simple. Then every September I would go back to the States and had to look for a new job. But I got to ESPN because in 1994, I used to do something that my wife does now. We did the pre-game, post-game and halftime of the All-Ireland football and hurling on WFUV Fordham University. So I had all this built into my
And what
profile.
Were you doing though? What was your job though?
I was a house painter.
Was a hobby.
This was a hobby. Yeah. And I also announced the games in Gaelic Park. In Gaelic Park, where they play the
in
Irish.
New York, yes.
I announced the games in the stadium. So 1991, I guess it was. 1991. It was announced that ESPN the US was going to host the 1994 World Cup. So I picked up the phone, I called ESPN and I said, I need to speak to the guy that's running the World Cup for ESPN.
Right.
And this guy picked up the phone to me and asked me what I wanted, and I told him what I wanted, and he invited me up for lunch.
And what did you want?
I wanted a job doing the World Cup.
Right.
I told him I wanted a job doing the World Cup, and he said, do you have any experience? Well, I said, come down to the Bronx any Sunday. I said, you'll hear me in Gaelic Park. I said, and if I can do a job in Gaelic Park, I said, I can do a job anywhere. I said, when you have lads shouting the things that they be shouting at me in Gaelic Park, I can withstand anything. So, I didn't get a job actually at that point. I did one game. I did Ireland against Italy,
brilliant game to do.
Yeah, which really was the World Cup. You didn't need to do anymore. Yeah. You did the World Cup.
Ray Houghton's goal.
That's right.
And Paul McGrath's hero-like
dynamite.
Performance.
Yeah. Dynamite. And, after that then, I got the call from ESPN, because that was ESPN Big Boys. So ESPN Little Cousin, which was ESPN International, which broadcast to 153 countries, had just come on the air then. Now, I had never done a soccer game, and I was coming home here to Ireland, and I got a call from a woman. She said, we want you to do a game between Santos and Guarani. I'll never forget it, in the Paulista League in Brazil, right? So the first thing I had to do was, I had to realise that, Spanish and Portuguese are not the same.
Ooh, well done.
They were in Knockbridge, but they weren't anywhere else. So I came home and I'm saying to myself, now I've never done a game on television. So I gathered all my nieces and nephews and I put them into the car, and Dundalk was playing Limerick on a very cold Sunday afternoon at Oriel Park. And I took them into the stadium. I sat in the middle of them and I did a commentary for, I think there was 7 or 8 of them. Right. So I did a live commentary for them and I asked them their opinions after. They were like 9, 10, 11 years old. And I said, if you can satisfy those guys, you can satisfy anybody. Yeah. So I go back to the States. Right. And the woman called and said, OK, the game is on such a night. And I had a good friend who worked as a baker in Long Island City. He was a Kilkenny man. and he had some Brazilian guys there. But I always remember, Ray, the night the game was played, right? Santos, I knew all about because of Pelé. Everybody knew about Pelé. But Guarani, I didn't even know how to pronounce it, right? But there were two lads on the team. There was Alex and Dennis. And at that time, they had me doing play-by-play. Now I'm an analyst. Right. At that time, I had to describe the action.
Yes.
Well, if you were listening to that game that night, you would say Alex and his friend
Dennis.
Was,
they were the only ones who were playing.
They were going to be on the World Cup team. They were going to be on the World team. Because whenever there was a doubt, one of them got the ball and one of them passed to the other fella. And that was the way it went for the 90 minutes. And they loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rest after that, forget about it.
Yeah, but you still have, after all those years, over five decades, you still have the loud accent. It's strong and it's there. And did you make a conscious decision to keep it or...?
No. I never make conscious decisions about anything. Don't you hear I made a conscious decision about what to marry. My uncle used to say to me, marry a woman from Cork and you'll always have some place to go on your holidays. And he was right, I did. I married a woman from Cove and I go down there every year on my holidays down to Ballard and it's great. Yeah, but, yeah. You know, if you start taking yourself too seriously and making conscious efforts about everything or conscious decisions about everything, you'll never get anywhere.
I was trying to describe you to somebody earlier on, and I was going, if you can imagine some sort of hybrid of Marty Morrissey and the late Jimmy McGee, and that doesn't even do you justice. That doesn't even do you justice. Because there's a boldness about you as well. Because I saw a sort of a ESPN best bits of Tommy Smith that they put together. There's a sort of irreverence about you, and you don't, as you say, you definitely don't take yourself seriously. But at any opportunity, you'll dress up.
Oh, yeah.
Or sing a song.
Yeah.
Or
yeah. Well, you know, I had the pleasure of doing 19 Champions League finals. Now, and when you do a Champions League final for ESPN, it was a week long job. So you'd have to go to the city that the final was on.
Barcelona or Istanbul or whatever it was.
And I had to take up parts of, you know, whatever city you were in, you became a Swiss guard or you became something like that. So I would always dress up. And I'll tell you one thing, to some of those tapes, you shouldn't look at them really because they weren't done that well, but there was a lot of things that wasn't covered up, let me tell you.
So there's a sort of a travel program element to it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You give a flavour of where you are.
Yeah, ESPN always has this thing. They believe that the people should tell the story of the city you're in and then the event takes place in the city.
Uh-huh.
That was the way they always approached it.
Okay. Now, I've been saying since I mentioned your name that it's Smith with a Y and that's become your calling card, isn't it? Where did that come from?
It came from the fact that that's the way we spell our name.
I know, but
no, but when I joined ESPN, the internet was only very young, right? But then as it started coming in, I mean, ESPN started getting all these SMITH ones.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And I said, look it. And the guy said to me one day, he said, why didn't you just say Smith with a Y, he said, and it'll be a calling card, he said, nobody will ever mistake it again. And it turned out to be one of the best calling cards I had.
Tommy Smith with a
Tommy
Y.
Tommy Smith with a Y.
Of course, there's a Y in Tommy. I don't mean to be pedantic, Tommy.
That's true. There is. There's Ys everywhere.
So I've changed it for you. I said Tommy Smith.
Go.
And that's Smith with a Y. So just, I've added
Tommy with a Y and Smith with
a
Y.
Yeah. And the other thing is your onion bag reference. And that's an old reference to the net in a game of soccer, isn't it, a game of football?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, myself and the fella from Navan were sitting down one night, we were talking about it. And he said, every commentator in the States, he said, has a calling card, he said. Right. And we decided this should be it. Because if you, realistically, at that time, the nets were red and the ball was white, still is, of course. The nets are not red anymore. But when the ball struck the net, I mean, it's just like an onion sitting in an onion bag.
Yeah.
But what's even more I'm very proud of is I went to, 2 years ago, I went to the Philadelphia Union and started announcing their games in MLS after I retired from ESPN. And they had this thing called doop, doop, doop when it was a score. It was just a statement. There was nothing to it, right? So I adopted my doop in the old onion bag. And the lads in the supporters club there went and they built an onion bag behind the goal. Now when there's a goal scored, this guy takes a big onion, he cuts it with its chainsaw and he takes over a slice and he puts the slice in my onion bag.
Right.
You couldn't write it.
No, you couldn't. This is just 27 seconds of your very long career. How many years did you do in ESPN?
26.
So this is a second for every year.
Yeah, okay.
And look at that, he puts the buzz in the old onion bike. And he puts it in the roof of the old onion bike. Denny Cooley, calmly, buzzes the old onion bike.
This is Tommy Smith with a Y.
He's going to put one in the back of the old onion bag.
This is Shaka.
Straight into the old onion bag. I'm Tommy Smith with a Y.
You've got Tommy Smith with a Y.
We've got Tommy Smith with a Y.
Yeah! Till next time, I'm Tommy Smith with a Y.
There you go. And we've Tommy Smith with a Y in studio with us.
Those lads, that was the New Zealand team. And Tommy Smith was playing in the World Cup with New Zealand. So that was when ESPN approached them. That's what they said, because we used to broadcast three or four times a day in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So they adopted that. We got Tommy Smith with an I, you got Tommy Smith with a Y.
And of course, you're a sports fan, Tommy. So as you're saying, you were living the dream. And yeah, you've met some of the greatest. You've interviewed David Beckham.
Yeah, spent a week with him in Madrid. Unbelievable guy. One of the nicest people you could ever meet in your life. It's amazing how the persona that you imagine about these guys is nowhere near what they're like. Yeah. I mean, Roy Keane, I mean, I couldn't meet a nicer guy. Unbelievable. The way he treated me was just incredible. I didn't like him calling me Bio, but that was all right.
Bio, he called
bio,
you
Bio,
yeah,
right. Bio.
Yeah, yeah. You're good at your own PR. There's a clip in that. Now, they left it in for the crack.
Yeah.
But you're in front of, it looks like a diner someplace in some small town in America, and there's a couple of teenage boys, and you're instructing them what to say.
Yeah.
So you go through.
Well, actually, what happened there was they had said it, and the guy missed the camera.
Oh, right. Is that your story?
I said to them, say it again.
Which was... You're a legend, Tommy
Smith.
You're a legend,
okay.
You're a legend, Tommy Smith, which is the ultimate. The ultimate. What about, because they obviously love your turn of phrase, which is an Irish turn of phrase, a loud turn of phrase, but sometimes it gets lost in translation and maybe there's a bit of a mix-up, is there? Because I think the last time we spoke to you was the use of a word.
Mm. You're going down a rabbit hole now, aren't you?
No, but like, I would use that word.
Yeah.
Jizz. I would use that word as in energy and enthusiasm.
You just did.
Yes. But in America, it means something completely different. So you used it with reference to an English player in the World Cup, did you?
No, it was actually England were playing Italy.
Yeah.
And it was Pirlo. And Pirlo was in his prime that time. It was in 2010, South Africa. And I was doing the quarterfinal, I'd say. And I was doing it with JP. And JP is a very vanilla type Irish. JP Della Camera. He's a very vanilla type American who has no turn of phrase. He just does everything straightforward and there's no colour to it at all.
Right.
He just does it. So he said to me when the teams came out on the field in the second half, he said, because Pirlo was after having a terrible game, he was walking. And he said, what's wrong with Pirlo? And I said, he just has no jizz today at all. And I was watching, I had the computer on and the internet started going tick, 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 tick. And I said to myself, oh, I just said something wrong there, didn't I? And I didn't realise.
No, of course, wouldn't you? It's innocent. It's innocent.
Yeah, and to compound the problem then, I said to JP, I said, by the way, JP, I said, where I come from, I said, in Knockbridge, I said, we call that having a lack of energy when you say jizz.
Yeah.
And the computer went crazy again. He said it again. I mean, you know, you just, it's amazing how you can be mistaken.
Let's see what they're saying about you, Tommy. Your guest today, Tommy, what a great guy. I played football against him in Gaelic Park in the Bronx. Ask him about Aidan Wiseman, great loud footballer. Say hello to Tommy from Michael Burke from the Bronx, living in Castle Island in Kerry.
Michael, I didn't start writing the book yet. Mike sends me an email every week telling me what chapter I should be in the book now.
But
I didn't get it yet, Mike.
Your book.
Yeah, my book.
Best wishes to Tommy from Richie Kelly, musician in Carlow. Was jumping out of the car to go to work meeting when I heard you mention you'll be speaking to Tommy Smith on the show today. Tommy is a dear old friend of my parents, Tom and Kay Lillis. And from what I heard, they got up to all sorts with him when they lived out in New York in the 1970s. They even used to help out on his radio show for the crack. My folks speak about Tommy so fondly and are listening in now. It's Dad's birthday tomorrow, so please ask him to wish him a happy birthday. Best love, best wishes to Tommy, love, Rachel. So that's Tom and Kay. So it's Tom and Kay Lillis.
Tom Lillis, all the way from Corra Clare and County Clare. And yes, they used to help me out on the show. I started my radio show in 1969 because at that time the show bands had come out and I couldn't get the music. So I started the show and Tom and Kay helped me. Eventually, Trasa took over the show. She runs the show now.
It's still very successful.
Yeah. Trasa's the wife. And Tom, I hope you have a great birthday. I'm not sure what birthday it is. I won't even try to go there, but I hope it's a good one.
Speaking of birthdays, what age are you, Tommy?
I'm not sure. When you get to my age, you forget what age you are. You know, you forget a lot of things.
People can do the maths. You're out there 54 years and you were 17 when you left. So yeah. You're right.
And I've been at the Galway races, I think, maybe 45
have
or 46
times. You always come home for them?
Yeah, myself and my brother Colm and Teresa and Trasser were heading off Monday to Ballybrit. You know, It's easy. There's a bunch of guys come in with bags full of money. You just have to guess the right horse and they put the hand in the bag and they give you the money. How could you go wrong? You couldn't go wrong.
Had the pleasure of being in New York in 2008 where Tommy Smith led the St. Patrick's Day parade up Fifth Avenue. Yes, you were the Grand Marshal in St. Patrick's Day. That must have been a special moment, Tommy, was it?
Yeah, very special moment, because an awful lot of people don't realise is that the St. Patrick's Day Parade has been in existence 15 years before the United States became the United States. And it has run consecutively every year. It has never missed out. There was one year that there was a fantastic blizzard and the Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade at that time would ride a horse and he'd have five or six outriders with him to come up the avenue. And he came up the avenue and went the whole route of the parade to tell people that the parade wasn't going to come behind him. So they said, well, the parade was completed. Grand Marshal ran it. You know,
What was it like?
Ray, it was the greatest moment in my life besides the day I was married. So, it was something that I never believed would ever happen to me. No loud man has ever been Grand Marshal of St. Patrick's Day Parade. It was the greatest honour in most Irish people's opinion that go to the United States. It's the greatest honour any Irish man or any Irish woman can have. I mean, to be chosen as the Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade on the particular day that I was Grand Marshal, and it's documented, there were 3.5 million people who lined the streets. And there were 275,000 people who marched in the parade. Now, when Obama was inaugurated, he only had 3 million people at his inauguration. So I beat him by 500,000.
And they're all there for you, Tommy Smith with a Y.
That's right.
Yes.
There you go, Tommy Smith with a Y. But it was an amazing feeling.
Tommy is a legend here in America. Great to have him at Philadelphia Union for game day commentaries. Ask him about the onion bag. We've done that. That's John O'Rourke in Philadelphia. And I wish Tommy your sincerest good wishes and thank you for your friendship and kindness over many years. John and Peggy. And great to hear Tommy Smith on the radio, a man who's never lost his roots and even kept his accent. Wishing him the very best from Declan Louth. Of course, you were at Dundalk last night.
I was.
And it was a one-all draw against Quarabeg.
Quarabeg, yeah.
Yeah.
Azerbaijan. I love saying that, Azerbaijan. Yeah, they were lucky, unlucky and lucky. You know, to give away a corner kick in the first half, which should never have happened. Quarterback never got into the dock half and somebody miskicked the ball. It ended up going out for a corner. And from the ensuing corner kick, it took a deflection and ended up in the net. And that was the only thing Quarterback did. And then Huben got a header to put Dundalk level at one apiece. And with the very last kick of the ball, Ray, the ball broke down in the box and there was a lad looking at it. And you couldn't see a goalkeeper. All you could see was a big piece of the old onion bag. And he put it over it.
Ah.
Oh, I'll tell you one thing. But the atmosphere was fantastic. And Dundalk FC, I must say, treated myself and Trasser very well last night.
I mentioned that you're now working on, is it Amazon Prime?
Amazon Prime, yes.
So you're doing commentary for the UK and Ireland on NFL games?
Yes, I'm doing it for the US as well.
Oh, doing US as well?
Yeah, because what they did was they signed a contract that they were going to use European guys to do it, but they didn't say that they weren't going to have it in the US. So it's available in the US because Amazon Prime is available everywhere now.
And this is oddly, and in your, you know, it's old.
At my age, when you start to forget things,
you've become a cult figure with American football fans.
Yeah, it's amazing. It has gone really well. I do it with a fella called Derek Ray, who a lot of people in Scotland would know as the man who was doing, he was doing the Scottish League on BT for several years. And I used to do Champions League with him and a lot of other things. And we ended up doing it and it's turned out, I'm the first ever analyst who's not a native-born American who has ever done the NFL on national television.
Right.
They said I couldn't do it. They laughed. They were laughing. When Tommy Smith's going to do the NFL.
I've been reading a few tweets and articles and they love your accent. Is that you or me?
That's you. I don't have a phone. I can't afford one.
They love your accent and they also love your honesty. And your turn of phrase, like in one, you were saying the quarterback, it opened, the other, it opened up in front of him. You said you could drive a bus through that. Now, it'd be a minibus, not a big bus.
Well, it wasn't a big gap, you know, yeah, it was just a small gap. Just
a 14-seater.
Yeah. You know, there's no point in doing sports if you're not honest about it.
Yeah.
You know, sports is not a religion. Sports is meant to be an entertainment. People are intended, you know, to spend a whole week doing something that some of them don't like, and you get the release on the weekend to go and do it or watch it on television. So when I do a game on television, I tell it exactly like I see it.
Despite what Matt Busby said, it's not life or death.
No, it's not. No. It's worse than that.
Yeah, that's it. Did you ever think of going back home and doing it over here? Did you ever have any offers from...
No, I never had.
No, RTE never.
No,
They never came knocking.
No, I did overseas requests many years ago on RTE for some time before Tracer took over the programme. Right. I used to do the overseas requests. I did with Mike Murphy. In fact, I heard from Mike recently from Florida. Yeah, he's still going strong. And I go back as far as Tracy Davis.
Yes, I remember Tracy. Yeah, overseas requests. Yeah.
And Valerie McGovern.
When you think about that, and that was a big deal, reading out requests from people who weren't living in the country, how the world has changed.
It has changed an awful lot. People just say to me, what's the biggest change you had since you went to the United States? And the biggest change I do tell people, and they think I'm nuts when I tell them this, right? To make a phone call to my mother would be 3 days.
Knockbridge.
I would have to call McNamee's pub and I would say to Tom McNamee, could you have my mother there tomorrow for a phone call? Or the next day. I couldn't say tomorrow because he mightn't see her. And then he would have her there. And, you know, Americans would always say to me, you were cheap, weren't you? Why didn't you buy your mother a telephone? At that time, there was a 7-year waiting list to get a phone into your house. So that was the... And, like, it was $5 a minute at that time. Now you can talk to fellas and look at them. Sometimes you don't want to see them, but they are. You talk to them for free.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy what has happened.
Listen, it's been a real pleasure chatting to you for the last half hour or so. Enjoy the Galway races. Lovely to meet you and Tracy. I'm sure we'll speak again.
Hopefully. Thank you very much. Tommy Smith with the Y.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or Ray at RTE.ie. Now we're joined in Studio 10 by Teresa Mannion. Good afternoon, Teresa.
Thanks, Ray.
And Teresa is fronting a lovely idea, night walks for night nurses. And it's Irish Cancer Society, and they've been helped out by Boots. And it's happening in Dublin in the Phoenix Park on the 16th of August at 7:30 in the evening. And then the week after at Blackrock Castle in Cork. That's the 23rd of August and it's starting at 7 o'clock. And you can sign up for €15 to help the Irish Cancer Society at eventbrite.ie. Eventbrite.ie, and that's Bright, B-R-I-T-E, as opposed to with the G and the H. So that's all that. And of course, people know your cancer story.
Yes,
how long ago was it now?
Right, it's 6 years. I had my last mammogram there a couple of months ago. It was February 2013. So I'm actually great, you know, 6 years on. I can't believe it myself when I think back to that time. It was, in some ways, it was like yesterday, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm great.
And you're out the other side.
And
early detection, to say over and over again. And you were lucky in that respect.
Absolutely. I mean, I called it my dot of cancer. It was so tiny. I didn't even have a lump. I had no history of breast cancer. There was nothing other than a letter from Breast Check that was on my kitchen counter for 6 months. And I thought, you know, Breast Check is 4 minutes walk from my house. Shame on me for not availing of this. I think it was Mary Harney. It was her legacy. And I went and I availed of it. And they put me through a lot of tests, you know, mammogram, ultrasound, biopsies, because it was so tiny. But they found it. And people sometimes criticise Breast Check for over-screening. But for me, I'm here with you today. I had a really aggressive breast cancer called triple negative. And there's nothing you could do if it came back, you know, so that's why I was put through all the treatment.
So it's not overstating it when I say that screening saved your life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Maybe I would have found the lump and I would have done something about it, but maybe not. So yes.
So the message is go out there and get checked.
But obviously the campaign that I'm supporting this time out is for people who are actually in the latter stages.
And it's about night nurses, and you can't overstate the service that they provide to people in the final you know, months and weeks of their lives.
Yeah, they're like Florence Nightingales. I met one yesterday when I was doing the photo call for the campaign, Mary Attridge, and she'd just come off her shift. And she was just the essence of calm. And they go into people's families and they make the patient the absolute priority. And if that person wants to sleep, they will stay with them through the night. They'll leave them sleeping if they want to talk, if they want their hand held, if they need care during the night, if they need to go to the bathroom, if they want to watch a movie, if they want to share a joke or even offload. You know, sometimes the kindness of strangers. And she said often some of the patients open up and tell her a lot, and she's almost like a go-between. So it's like she's got the practical professional nursing experience combined with being like a mediator and being empathetic. I think they call it angels, and they have it's like being assessed. N is for patient needs, G is for giving on a spiritual, a physical, an emotional level, a practical level. Empathy is sitting and being with the person you're with for those few days, listening very carefully if they want to talk, and laughter. She said it's amazing the jokes and the laughter that you can have as well. And sharing then is about going back to the palliative community support team and updating them on the patient.
And it allows people to live out their final days at home, which is so important.
I mean, at the end of the day, isn't that what everybody wants? People always want to be in their own homes. Hospitals are essentially, they're life-saving. They're not an environment conducive to passing away peacefully, even if you're in a private room. They're about saving lives. They're about emergencies and trolleys and rushing medical teams and fluorescent lighting. They're not, hospices are wonderful places, but home is where people want to be. If they're still lucid and conscious and are aware of that they're in their final hours or days or weeks, then they want to be at home. And then the family, these angels that come into their lives, they can get a night's sleep so that they can then be their best selves with the patient, who also might have the energy to interact. Because sometimes when you're in the throes of cancer, you don't even want to raise a smile, let alone talk to anybody. Yeah. You know?
So it's a lovely initiative. Yeah. Night Walks for Night Nurses and eventbrite.ie, that's B-R-I-T-E. And they're happening on the 16th of August in Phoenix Park, and then on the 23rd of August in Blackrock
and
Castle.
Briefly, €2 all if you go into Boots anywhere across the country for an honour tag, and you do a metre of the walk in honour of your loved one and write a little message on the back of the tag. It's €2.
You were in Esker Hill Golf Club during the week.
I was.
Well, it's great to meet. That's in doing what you do, and I get some of it as well. You can be part of history.
You got to meet Olivia Newton-John. Yeah, I was so jealous. Yeah, I know. It's great, isn't it?
What was the atmosphere like?
It was unbelievable. I mean, there were these people who knew him since he was a little boy, and he was down in that golf club morning, noon and night, and his parents would drop him off in the morning and he'd have a bottle of Fanta and a Mars bar after a good practice. His transition year was spent in that golf club. He didn't go anywhere else. Boy, did it pay off. They're so, so proud. And they're very lovely people. Ray Malloy and all his brothers run the club, and they were just delighted to be the centre of all the media frenzy. And we went live on the 6 and the 9 o'clock news from there. They were giving out to me because they thought I'd brought the rain. It was bucketing down relentlessly.
And you were saying, do make unnecessary journeys. Come here and celebrate Shane Lowry's victory.
Exactly. It was wonderful. It's hard to describe, actually. It's a modest club, and Clara is such
a small
town.
There's only 200 members.
Well. 200 members, yes. I know.
And Clara, what, 2,500 population?
Yeah, it's tiny. Yeah. It's tiny. I just thought it was one of those really marvellous feel-good stories. Yeah. It was just so, so good.
And everybody got behind it.
Yeah.
You've had a tough enough year. Your dad died at Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. What age was he?
He was 85. He was a good age. And he was a great old character. And I would have loved to have been with him now. You know, the seven of us, like, you're a big family as well, aren't you?
Nine.
And we would have loved to have been around him. I think my brothers missed him by about 10 minutes. He'd gone through for a man of 85, he had spinal surgery, and he also had Alzheimer's. And I think in the end, it was all too much for him. Right. I think the medics did their very best because he was in such chronic pain. He had a tumour at the base of his spine, and they were trying to they're trying to eat, take as much of it out.
Yes.
So, you know, we don't regret that we made that decision for him to have surgery.
Because you had to make the decision.
Yeah, we had to.
You have power of attorney, did you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we did. And we miss him terribly. I mean, he was just such a great character. He was the real old dub, you know, with West of Ireland roots. He loved to be all things to all people. But
how's your mum?
My mum's, she's in a nursing home now. She had a very, very bad fall and on the stairs. And both of them were actually in hospital at the same time. So they went from being a wonderful role model pensioners in their 80s who were always out walking, going to the hairdressers, going around the corner to Mass and Christ the King in Cabra. They were so well known. My dad was back living in the area he grew up because they had been living in Mayo for 15 years. He went off, just go back to his roots, you know. But they were, it all happened very suddenly. The 80s is a tough decade. Yeah. My mom has dementia now. She knows us. Some days she thinks I'm her sister, but other days I'm Teresa. But we're getting there. And I think families all over the country will resonate. It'll resonate, yeah. You know, because it's a terrible question.
I think watching somebody lose their mind is nearly worse than watching them lose their physical health.
Oh, you know what? It's so true. It's awful. No, the very thoughts of it happening. To imagine you thinking that that's ahead for you. Mm. I was at a concert in Galway the other night. Burt Bacharach, 91, on stage, lucid and funny, and banter between songs that he didn't even have to do. And I was actually nearly crying because I kept thinking of my own mother and going, "Gosh, how do some people go into their 90s and be so so vibrant, and their cognitive
together,
abilities
yes.
remain so good." But look, you know, again, I'm sure their advances are being made in medical science all the time, and they'll be able to isolate whatever gene we're carrying and maybe be able to help us.
They're understanding more and more about dementia and Alzheimer's as we go on. So now the family home is not there's nobody in it.
We're in it, in and out. We're passing through all the time. It's very strange. You go into and it's sort of frozen in time, and you kind of, there are moments where something just kind of gets you in your tracks, you know, whether it's see my dad's favourite Aran jumper or my mother's cup with, she was, her name's Kay, and there's a Kay on a mug, and I opened a press and I saw the mug and I'm like, oh my God, it's mummy's mug, you know, and everything is there except them. Yeah, it's tough, but look, you know, the more awareness we bring all the time, the more we can do to understand and meet their needs. And I think touch and smiling and eye-to-eye contact, all of those things, and you get flashes of lucidity, and that we come away from the nursing home feeling good when my mum gives us a great big smile and recognises us. Yeah.
Right. Eventbrite for that. Night walks for night nurses. Great to talk to you. Sorry that's, you know, it's all that's going on. It's a tough time, isn't it? Mm. And as you say, it'll resonate with thousands, hundreds of thousands of people all over the country. Teresa, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming
in. Thanks, Ray.
We have a quick commercial break to take before Nooked.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Just things that we from the previous hour. Thank you to Tommy and Trasa. They did a lovely tribute on his radio show on Saturday night to our dad Sean Fay, who passed last year. That's from All the Fays. And another one on Tommy there. So lovely to hear Tommy Smith on the show. He's a legend. He has helped thousands of people who left Ireland to make a life in New York City. He was a lifeline for many, finding them somewhere to live, a job and a connection to other Irish people. He looked after me for the 13 years I lived in New York City. I'm honoured to know him. Best wishes, that's Sandra Moriarty. 5 on 5, 5 on RadioRTE.ie. We're staying in New York with a sort of diversion to Corbly in Limerick. 56 years ago, a 17-year-old called Michael or Micheál Mulcahy rescued a 7-year-old Michael Downs from the canal bank in Corbly in Limerick. And Michael and Micheál have recently met up for the first time after all those years. So we have Michael Downs on the line from New York. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing wonderful.
Good to talk to you. There's a slight delay there, so we'll do our best around that. And we have Micheál Mulcahy closer to home down in Limerick. How are you doing, Micheál?
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good. So what do you remember about that day 56 years ago?
What do I remember about it?
Yeah.
I, I was at work. I was working in a joinery shop. It's a Canal Bank in Limerick. And some excitement started, and someone said there was a kid in the canal. A child had fallen into the canal, and we ran from the workshop out. I was an apprentice carpenter, serving my time at the time. And when I looked to the canal, there was no one in the water. So at that stage, Michael had gone. So I went headlong into the water, swam up and down a few times, and eventually said, let's get down. And went to the bottom of the canal and looked down at this boy below at the bottom of the canal. And I said, like, hell or high water, before I get my brother, I said, he's coming up with me. And that was the memory of my meeting with Michael, who I haven't met for 56 years since then.
So, Michael, what's your memory? You were 7 at the time. Were you living there, or were you on holidays, or what?
I was on holiday. Came over to see my parents' parents. So we were there for 3 months, and then I was just playing with some friends by the canal, and all of a sudden I slipped in, and I just remember flashing around for a little bit, and then I just got real calm, and I just accepted that that was the end of it. And then the next thing I remember, somehow I'm back up on the canal wall, and somebody had pulled me out. I didn't even know who it was. So now, 56 years later, I finally got to say thank you.
And what did you say when you went home to your granny?
I didn't say a word. I just came in. She said I was wet, so I just changed. I didn't want to get in trouble, so I just changed my clothes. And then they didn't find out about it until a day later when it came out in the paper in Limerick.
Right. Okay. And Micheál, what, 56 years is a long time for a reunion to be organised. How did the reunion happen?
It was most peculiar, because eventually we got Michael up onto the quayside at the canal. This is where the barges is coming, the old Guinness barges.
Yeah.
They were finished at the time, but the canal then was a different canal than it is now. But when we got Michael up on, he was fine. They left me in the water. with the excitement, you can understand, and I could understand. So, 17 years of age, world is my eyes, no problem. I was born and raised just under the cathedral in Galleon, Newcastle, View Terrace in Galleon,
yeah.
Right under the cathedral, so 5 minutes from the canal. So I was at home in the water there.
Yeah.
So I struck on after Michael been brought to the quayside, and I said I'd swim down to the steps, which was 50 or maybe 100 yards down, and then I realised I had boots, heavy gear, jumper on me, and it was all going on with Michael. So when eventually one of the lads shouted down, are you okay there? I said, I'm far from it. Will you get the bloody rope and give me a hand to get out of here? But by the time I came out, Michael was gone. I saw an ambulance go.
Right.
And maybe I was a few minutes now in the water there. And, of course, steep was. You know, it wasn't the bank. Like,
yes,
you see, so
yeah,
you,
yeah.
You had to swim out of that. But the thing was, when I got up, Michael was gone. And
so we'll go over to Michael now in New York. So take it up from there, Michael.
Exactly.
Explain the 56-year gap then to us.
Well, I can't really explain it. It just took me that long to come back and to say thank you to Micheál. And when the first time we met, it is like there was just a connection. We were bonded 56 years ago, and when we met, it was like we had known each other all those 56 years. It's just something when somebody does something like that for you, saves your life, make your children's life possible, your grandchildren's life possible. It's unbelievable. There's no way to say thank you, but that's what I tried to do.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mike. was really a most beautiful man. And the bond that has developed between the two. There was always a bond. It was an amazing thing that I've never seen him for that length of time. And when he came to my house here in Parthian and came to the door, it was as if it was we were brothers.
Oh, yeah.
A most beautiful,
we'd known each other for
that.
Yeah. So there was a big hug, was there?
Yep. Oh, what was the...
Oh, yeah.
But it was a strange feeling because once the hands gripped and the shake hands here at home, I said, my God, it was a strange, strange feeling. But the bond was glorious. And I have to say, his wife, Linda, and Michael, two most beautiful people. Mm. Absolutely beautiful people.
Well, listen, it's a wonderful story. And David Raleigh gave us the contacts there. So thanks to David. He had the story in the Irish Examiner and other papers. Michael and Michal, Gormila Mila Mahagiv. And we'll talk again. We'd love to have you in studio. 5 on 5, 5 on, Ray at RTE.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, we're joined in the studio by psychologist Alison Keating and psychoanalyst Ray O'Neill, and they are our relationship counsellors. and we've a lot to get through, and we've about 11 minutes to do all this, so let's get straight to it then. Dear Ray and Alison, I really appreciate your advice on this. My partner and I have been together for over a decade, and we have three wonderful children together. To be blunt, he's concerned with his rights regarding our children should anything happen to me. He mentioned that we could get court order deeming him legal guardian or co-guardian. I've suggested that we get married, and neither of us are interested in a big traditional wedding, but being his wife is becoming more and more important to me. He just brushes it off whenever I suggest it. I would love your advice, please. It's a difficult one. You go for it, Ray.
No, well, I suppose what I'd say is, in a way, I like that he makes the suggestion about like a court order and legal co-guardian, because what a marriage is fundamentally is a legal arrangement. So if you're going to get married, probably the first person, this is so unromantic of me, probably the first person to speak to is actually a solicitor. Because you're signing a legal contract. Mm. And maybe that's the way to have marriage. Because if you sit down with a solicitor and you kind of say, look, we're worried about parenting rights, this is the first solution a solicitor would offer. And so it's the solicitor suggesting it, and he has to think about that, rather than his partner suggesting it and feeling in any way pressured from her about it.
But if he gets married, he will become what he wants to achieve.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the advice comes from the solicitor and not from the pushy girlfriend or from... So she's taken out of the firing line.
They have three children. Probably a mortgage.
Ray. Irish men were great.
No, I mean, I think that's a great suggestion, but what I'm... should it really have to come from a solicitor? Shouldn't they sit down and have this chat together? He's obviously doesn't want to get married. And okay, but I'd be really interested as to why.
Yeah.
And then I'd be really interested as to what's going on for her. Why does she want to get married? What, you know, there's a real desire in that. I you know, it's becoming so important to her that she wants to be his wife. So is there a sense of that status for her as well, that, you know, within the family, for the kids, rather than it just being kind of legal? But it's a chat. It's a chat they need to have, I'd say, first, and then maybe go to the solicitor.
Mm. Is it because he's brushing her off that it's become more important to her?
Possibly.
You know?
Yeah, it might feel like a total rejection.
Yes. And if he wants to be co-guardian, why not get married?
Yeah.
That's alarm bells for me.
Mm. Mm.
Like, it could be just straightforward that he's some sort of commitment phobe, but if he wants to lay claim to the children before he scarpers, I know that's a doomsday scenario, mm. but...
He just might want to get married. And that's, I mean, everyone has the right to make that decision. But I think what needs to happen is both needs need to be heard. And is there any way some sort of compromise can come out of this that would work for both of them?
The brilliant thing about getting married in Ireland in 2019, is that you've so many options. You know, you have so many options there. And if you don't want a big traditional wedding, you can have fun with it.
Yes.
Because they're together. They're married and everything but name, really, aren't they?
Mm.
So they can have fun with it.
Well, I mean, they like 10 years. So it is somewhat legal at this stage, but it's better to find out for sure. I totally agree. There are so many different ways to get married.
Yeah. What's going on in his head, do you think, Ray?
Well, you see, that's a good question. I remember after the marriage referendum, these two lads coming to see me who'd been together for 18 years and a really great couple. I've no doubt that they loved each other, but one of them wanted to get married and the other didn't want to get married. And it was a real tension between them because they'd never had to face that question before 2015 and then they had to. And it was really difficult because what not getting married meant to one guy, the other guy had to listen to. And what getting married meant to the first guy, the other fella had to listen to. Yeah. So as Alison says, these two need to have a conversation in which isn't
and
about...
The guy who didn't want to get married, what was his...
It's just his parents had not sold marriage to him as a really good idea. Yeah, yeah. So he was just, he thought marriage would be the end of the relationship.
Okay, right.
And so it's always worth asking, rather than I don't want to do that, ask why? Why have you taken that stand? Because they have three kids together, they're on the same page. He wants to make more of a commitment. Though if his name's on the birth cert, he already is the legal co-guardian. But again, this is the kind of thing that a solicitor would make clear.
No, you have to apply to be, I think, if you're not married, you have to apply. Because I remember before we got married.
Right.
You know, like Jenny had more rights over the children than I did.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Like marriage would solicit. But if his name's on the birth cert, and if anything were to happen to her, which I presumed meant like he would be the next in line or whatever. Yeah. But again, like it's not that a solicitor will have all the answers, but whether it's the chicken or the egg, there are conversations to be had.
Okay, well, I hope that works out for you. Now, my daughter in her 20s has been diagnosed with a chronic long-term illness. She doesn't live at home and only occasionally gets in contact, but has always been pretty independent. I'm absolutely devastated by this diagnosis, which came out of the blue. I really want to help her and lie awake worrying whether she's taking her medication each day, when her next scan is, etc., etc. I know I'm not the only one in this situation, but I feel completely overwhelmed and my daughter just wants me to leave her alone to get on with it, but there are so many unanswered worries. Any advice?
So difficult. This mother is just distraught at what's going on for her daughter. Now, her daughter's in her 20s, so it's not like she's in her 40s. So I'd say that she's really struggling with kind of that sense of letting go of her, even though she is so independent. I wonder why she worries if she's not taking her medication. You know, has there been a time in the past where she hasn't minded herself? So that fear maybe is there for the mother if she thinks that she's not going to mind herself. I know, you know, the mom, it's very easy to say the mom needs to step back and not be involved in this, but as a mother, if my child was sick, you couldn't think of anything else. Mm-hmm. I just, again, wonder if they could sit down and I think with illness, it's so important not to push everything about how you're feeling onto the person, but to share with them. I am really worried. I'm so upset that this has happened for you. I would love to help, but I don't want to encroach. Can we figure out a way that this works for you as well? And you can tell me to back off when you need to, but I really want to be part and to help. But I also will take your guidance and step back when you need me to as well.
I would imagine if you get the diagnosis of a chronic long-term illness in your 20s, that anger could be an emotion that you'd feel very strongly. You know, you'd feel angry at the world.
Especially if it's genetic. Because if it's genetic, then unfortunately parents and grandparents are in the front line to blame. Like, there's a lot of emotions that are going on there. There's this gorgeous woman that I'm working with who has terminal cancer. She's in her late 30s. And she came to see me because she felt that she'd failed as a woman because she hadn't married and had kids. Right. And one of the things that really works is she said, "You're the only person in my care team who asks me, so did you get a smooch at the weekend? Any dates? Have you gone on Tinder? Yeah. You're not around for the long terms, and that's what all the fellas are all about, you Tinder." And she just laughs.
You're the USP.
But she just says, everyone else sees and tells me I'm dying.
Yeah.
But I want to live for the short time that I can live. And so your daughter might be pulling away because with the best of intentions, she doesn't want to be a sick daughter. She doesn't want to be a dying daughter. She wants to be your daughter. So I would encourage this mother to bring her grief and her worry and her fear to somebody, but not to her daughter.
Right. So keep the sunny side out sort of thing.
Again, without being false about it, but just sometimes it is. And this is, I suppose, I'm not a parent, but this is the price of being a parent. You love so much. So it's impossible. But for your daughter, she's not dead. She's living. She's hopefully loving. She hopefully has career ambitions and goes dancing at weekends or whatever it is. Mm. She needs to be seen as that person. Right. Then she'll thrive.
Right, good advice. Now, let's see, we have time for one more. Alison Ray, we are both in our 40s and have been together a year. We get on brilliantly in every way and can talk about everything. I've thought about having a child, especially at this age. He doesn't think he wants any. Do I stay and be grateful as we both feel so lucky to have met each other and be grateful for that? Or do I end it and try to meet someone else who I mightn't get on with as well or which might not happen and be too old to have a baby? I might end up with neither. Advice much appreciated. My word, that's anonymous. So in her 40s. So like it's time is of the essence, isn't it?
It really is. Like no matter how much, you know, quality we have in relationships and everything, at the end of the day, our biological clock is ticking, and it's ticking a while. From 35 onwards, it really kicks in so hard for women. So, you know, she needs to make a decision that, again, I think, can she not go back? Again, for me, it's like, should I not just be grateful and accept this as it is? Have they really had a big conversation about this? Or has he just said, look, I'm not really into it? This is not about getting him to agree, but it is really exploring what it actually means for her. And then in terms of the future. So what I would worry about is if they say they don't have a child and then she resents him. And that could be the end of the relationship as well.
It's not definitive there. He doesn't think he wants.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I don't get a sense of him saying that's it. We're done.
Doesn't seem like to be a deal breaker.
No. Go back.
And again, so I would encourage, like, get the information, like, because both being in your 40s, go and get some kind of assessment from a fertility expert to actually find out if it's an option. There's no point in getting yourselves upset if actually, unfortunately, the boat has already sailed.
Yeah, the decision might be taken out of your hands.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
which sometimes is good in life, isn't it?
But it's good to do that piece together. Yeah. And just look, we're going to no decisions made, but let's gather information so that we can make an informed decision.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Love
us. Both of you were brilliant today.
Excellent.
That's a really romantic date.
Really, Alison Keating, thank you very much.
Cheers, Ray.
Talk to you soon. That's it from us. Sarah McInerney is on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.